Lecture 17, The Schools of Tibetan Buddhism.
In the last lecture, we talked about the first diffusion of the Dharma in Tibet, and at the end of that lecture, I gave you a long digression about an experience that I once had with a representative of the Burn tradition, that very mysterious tradition that is sometimes talked about as being the indigenous religion in Tibet. Actually, as I mentioned in that lecture, Burn is now so thoroughly infused with Buddhism that it's hard to distinguish it from the Buddhism that we see elsewhere in the Tibetan tradition. Now, in this lecture, we want to pick up the historical narrative again and talk about the next major phase in the development of Tibetan Buddhism. This is a phase that we call simply the later diffusion of the Dharma in Tibet. And this took place in the 11th century, beginning in the 1000s. Now, this is associated with a string of important teachers. One of these is a man by the name of Atisha, who was an important scholar who came from one of the monasteries in eastern India and went up into Tibet and developed a group of Tibetan disciples, taught in the monasteries, and established a lineage that recreated some of that scholarly tradition from India that we've talked about when we discussed Buddhist philosophy. There also were some indigenous Tibetan figures who traveled to India and studied with tantric saints in India and came back to Tibet to promulgate the tradition of tantric practice that we also have talked about in discussing the Indian sources of Tibetan Buddhism. One of these saints was the tantric saint Marpa, about whom I'll say a bit in a minute. Now, out of these very tentative beginnings, just individuals floating through Tibet, beginning to reestablish some of those old lineages, grew most of the schools that have dominated Tibetan Buddhism to the present day. So our job in this lecture is to become familiar with the four major schools of Tibetan Buddhism, to understand how they got started and how they have contributed to the shape of Tibetan Buddhism as we would encounter it today in Tibet, or for that matter, in the Tibetan diaspora and all those Tibetan communities that are scattered around the rest of the world, including North America. Now, the place to begin in any survey of the four schools of Tibetan Buddhism was with a school known as the Nyingma school. This is the only one that traces its origin back before the later diffusion of the Dharma, back to the time of Padmasambhava, who was that tantric, an important tantric saint who helped Trisong Detsen found the monastery at Samye. He was a tantric magician, you might say, and helped quell the demons that seemed to stand in the way of the establishment of this important monastery. The word Nyingma in the name of this school means the old school. So the name of the school refers back to this early phase in the history of Tibetan Buddhism. Now, because of the gap between the first diffusion of the Dharma and the later diffusion, the gap between the 9th century and the 11th century, the connection between Padmasambhava and this later Nyingma tradition has always been pretty problematic. To establish the continuity with Padmasambhava, the members of this school, of the Nyingma school, claim to have discovered secret texts that Padmasambhava left behind in Tibet, hid sometimes in the landscape, written on the rocks on the bed of a river, or hidden in some cleft of the rock in the mountain, or sometimes buried in the minds of his disciples. And they have attempted to discover these texts, to interpret them, and then promulgate them in the present era. These texts are known as termas in Tibetan, a word that means simply treasure. And some of the most important and authoritative figures in Nyingma history are people who have discovered these termas and been able in some way to disseminate them. Now, to look into the development of the Nyingma tradition in some detail, it's not a bad thing, actually, to take a look at the lives of some of these so-called tertuns, the people who discover treasures and then make them available to others in their community, because they give a pretty remarkable glimpse of the way authority and charisma are negotiated and passed on in this tradition, especially a tradition where the origins are so shadowy, so buried in this ancient period of Tibetan life. A good example of the practice of the discovery and the teaching and the interpretation of termas is a figure by the name of Jigme Lingpa, who lived several centuries ago, and claimed to be a reincarnation of Triesong Detsen, who was, of course, Padmasambhava's cohort in the establishment of the monastery at Samye. Like many Nyingma lamas and like many Indian tantric saints, Jigme Lingpa spent many years in meditation, private seclusion in the mountains, and had the experience in his meditation of being visited by many of the important figures in the history of the tradition, including Padmasambhava and Trisong Detsen. In fact, when you read his autobiography, which is quite a wonderful text, actually, and gives you a very vivid account of some of the experiences that he had in his meditation, it's really wonderful to read some of the episodes where he gets up in the morning, he's been meditating all night in his dark cave, and the sun begins to rise on the eastern horizon, and he goes out to greet the dawn. You can imagine, I suppose, after meditating all night long, that your consciousness is in some strange way very much awake and very open to strange experiences, and up the trail in front of him comes a vision of Padmasambhava, who engages him in conversation and talks about how wonderful he is and how important he is in the transmission of this great teaching. Jigme Lingpa had lots of experiences like this and felt that he really was in communication with this ancient tradition of charisma and authority in the formation of Tibetan Buddhism. One of his most important revelations came to him in a dream, when he was transported in the dream down out of Tibet, across the Himalayas, and into the Kathmandu Valley in Nepal, where he visited the Swayambhunath Stupa, one of the great stupas in Kathmandu. While he was there, a heavenly messenger came to him and revealed a text in a form of writing that was impossible for him to understand. So he puzzled over the text. He read it with all of these mysterious little inscriptions, little characters on it. And finally, the heavenly messenger came to him and gave him the key to the code that he could use to unlock and interpret that text. And he did it. It became the beginning of a series of important revelations for him. And eventually, as he translated these and recorded them and dictated them to his disciples and so on, it became the nucleus for a new scriptural tradition in his community. Now, this story about Jigme Lingpa is not by any means an isolated story. There are other important revealers of termas in the Nyingma tradition, but it is a very important one and quite distinctive, and it tells us a lot about the Nyingma tradition and also, I think, quite a bit about Tibetan Buddhism in general. First of all, Nyingma and Tibetan Buddhism, to a large degree, are traditions founded on meditative experience. It's clear that that's the foundation of the authority of Jigme Lingpa. He was there in the mountains, and he was there for a long time. And while he was there, he had some strong experiences that affirmed not only the depth of his own meditation and his own realization, but his connection to this long lineage of teaching that took him all the way back to Padmasambhava, and through Padmasambhava, of course, to the ancient Buddhas of the Indian tradition. In this sense, Nyingma is probably the Tibetan tradition that comes closest to the pure transmission of the tantric impulse from Tibet. Jigme Lingpa didn't study, or at least he didn't study in any important way in any sophisticated monasteries. He wasn't a great student of philosophy. Most of what we talked about a couple of lectures ago when we talked about the different schools of Buddhist philosophy would have been pretty unfamiliar to him. He wasn't a scholar. His charisma and his power were established by the vividness and the plausibility of his own personal vision, came from his own meditation. The Nyingma tradition still maintains this character today. It appeals to people precisely because it puts its feet down on direct personal experience. But the Nyingma tradition and the story of Jigme Lingpa also convey the ancient Buddhist respect for scriptural transmission. We've talked about this a lot, actually, in the lectures that we've shared together on the history of Buddhism. Jigme Lingpa's authority may have been founded on personal experience, but it was expressed and it was spread in a text, in a body of texts. So even in its most esoteric and personal form, Tibetan Buddhism is devoted to texts. It's a strongly textual tradition. And these are not just old texts that come from the time of the Buddha, but texts that are generated by authoritative figures who manifest themselves from time to time, just bubble up from time to time in the history of Tibet. So you could say that Tibetan Buddhists have a canon of scripture. They do. It's big and quite widely disseminated. It was settled in the 13th century, and it contains within it what you might call the authoritative Tibetan definition of the teaching that came to Tibet from India. But in a broader sense, the Buddhist canon in Tibet, you would have to say, I think, still remains open, because new texts can be generated or discovered to respond to all sorts of new situations and then promulgated as the basis of authority in different sectarian movements. So there is in Tibetan Buddhism something like a scriptural impulse, a textual impulse that, of course, reveres ancient texts, and copies them and passes them on in all the ways that it happens in a Buddhist culture, but also tries to find textual material, as it were, that can respond in a distinctive way to the issues that we face or that Tibetans faced in a new historical situation. Now, the Nyingma tradition that's represented here by Jigme Lingpa has come to North America. You can encounter it here in various Tibetan communities. And interestingly enough, I think it's quite popular among scholars who study the tradition intellectually in a very intense way, but kind of have a hunger for some personal experience. And they often study with Nyingma teachers to make that direct personal encounter with the Dharma that sometimes seems difficult to discern in the more complicated intellectual accounts of the tradition that you see amongst the philosophers. So those are a few comments about the Nyingma tradition, about its history and about its shape, and also about what it tells us about the tradition of Tibetan Buddhism more generally. Another school that's interesting to encounter is a school called the Kagyu school. The word Kagyu means teaching lineage, and it traces its origin to the Lama Marpa, who lived between the years 1012 and 1096. He was a Tibetan by birth, but he traveled to India and studied with tantric teachers in the Tibetan monasteries. And he brought their texts back to Tibet to serve as the foundation of a new lineage. Now, as I mentioned at the end of my lecture on Buddhist tantra, this word lama in the Tibetan tradition is, of course, quite common. It's the equivalent of the Sanskrit word guru, which means a religious teacher, somebody who teaches you something, but also, in a sense, passes on a lineage of power and authority to you. The guru or the lama is particularly important in tantra because the secrecy and danger of the tantric tradition are always present, and it's important to receive a tantric teaching, if you can, from a teacher who can tailor it effectively to you and help ward off some of the difficulties that might come if you misinterpret tantric teachings and apply them in a dangerous way. Lamas are so important in Tibetan Buddhism that Tibetan Buddhism itself is sometimes referred to as Lamaism. I suspect this is a name, actually, that you've encountered if you run across Tibetan Buddhism, especially in some old-fashioned travelogues or literary texts. People often talk about Tibetan Lamaism. We don't use that term very much anymore, but the word expresses an important truth about Tibetan Buddhism, that it really does rely on the Lama, the teaching and personality of the Lama. In fact, you might say that in Tibetan Buddhism, the Lama is really not just the first person that you encounter in the teaching, but really stands in for you as if that Lama were the Buddha. I could say as if he were the Buddha, but there also are important female Lamas in Tibet too. So let's just say as if he or she were the Buddha sitting right in front of you. The Lama, in some sense, in a tantric teaching at least, is an embodiment of the Buddha's presence. Now, Marpa's most important disciple, and the person who carried on his teaching in the most powerful way, was a man by the name of Milarepa, who lived from 1040 to 1123, and is one of Tibet's most beloved saints. The biography of Milarepa is one of the best ways, I think, to come to terms, become familiar with the life, the typical life of a Tibetan saint, especially the life of a Tibetan saint who is deeply respected and loved by the tradition in general. Milarepa, I love the story, I must say, and I read it with my students, again, as we have often commented on in the course of these lectures, because Milarepa began as a reluctant student. And so we can all relate to him, I think, especially in the early phases of his career. He starts out as a rather weak-willed and sort of not very well-organized young man. Of course, none of us know any people like that. But Milarepa at least started out as a disorganized, weak-willed, and somewhat malleable young person. And his mother, at least in the very beginning of the story, is the person who really puts fire in his belly. It turns out that Milarepa's father died when he was a young man, and relatives of Milarepa stole the family's property. And Milarepa's mother was deeply angered by this and wanted to seek revenge against the relatives. So she took this malleable young man and she sent him off to study with one of the black magicians in Tibet and learn the black arts so that he could wreak revenge on these relatives. He learned how to use the mantras, the chants that would help him call down hailstorms on the relatives' fields and even kill some of them through natural phenomena like hailstorms. He did this, it worked. His mother was pretty satisfied, but Milarepa got a little worried by this because he realized that what he was doing was creating enormously bad karma. And unless he could find some way to remove this karma, this stain from his personality, that he would end up in one of the lowest Buddhist hells. So he began to wonder himself about where he could find a teacher that would help him achieve enlightenment in this life and remove the weight of this guilt. He studied with a couple of different teachers and it didn't work all that well for him. And he finally was advised to go and find a man by the name of Marpa, who would give him the teaching that he needed. So he went off to look for Marpa in the place where Marpa lived. And I must say that the traditional account of that first meeting between Milarepa and Marpa is one of the most exquisite little descriptions of an initial encounter between a teacher and a student that I'm aware of anywhere in the Tibetan tradition. I'll read you just a piece of it. At the side of the road, Milarepa saw a tall and corpulent monk with large eyes and an awesome look plowing a field. I had scarcely seen him, he said, when I was filled with unutterable joy and inconceivable bliss. Stunned for a moment by this vision, I remained motionless. Then I said, Master, I've heard that the learned Marpa the translator, personal disciple of the glorious Naropa, dwells in this region. Where is his house? For a long time he looked me head to foot, looked me up and down. Then he said, "Who are you? Who are you who is asking me this question?" I replied, "I am a great sinner and I come from the upper Tsang. Marpa is so renowned that I have come to beg for his teaching." "Very well, I shall arrange for you to meet Marpa. Meanwhile, plow the field." He took from the ground a jar of beer which he had hidden under his hat, and he gave it to me. The beer was refreshing and very good. "Work hard," he said, and he went away. Now, we spend a little time in my classes when we talk about the Milarepa story trying to decide which kind of beer sat under the hat in this Tibetan field. I'm not sure we can really identify it with anything that sits on the supermarket shelf today. It obviously was chang, that barley beer that they use in Tibet. And I imagine on a hot day on the Tibetan plateau plowing a barley field that some of this old barley beer would taste pretty good. But what really strikes me most about this is not so much the image of the beer, but that sweating monk. I mean, I just said a minute ago that the Lama, in a way, is the Buddha for this, for a disciple in the tantric tradition in Tibet. So this is an image of the Buddha. You know, you're walking down a dusty Tibetan road. There's a fat old guy, a tall and corpulent monk, sweating in the sun, plowing a field. And who is he for Milarepa? He is the embodiment of the Buddha himself. It's a really extraordinary image. And it shows you something, I think, about the down-to-earth and pragmatic quality of the tantric tradition. It can be embodied in a figure as common, as accessible as this. Anyway, the story goes on from this. This is just the beginning. And Milarepa and Marpa have a difficult relationship. Marpa really puts Milarepa through intense trials. He orders him to build a tower out of stones, and he tells him to tear it down. This goes on several times, and Milarepa becomes in a state of almost complete despair. At one point, he tries to run away. And he realizes that running away from Marpa itself isn't going to solve the problem. And finally, he comes back in tears and begs for Marpa's forgiveness and for his teaching. Marpa finally gives that to him in an experience of initiation that I can read you also a piece of to indicate what a tantric initiation is like in Tibet, especially in this early period. "When my clothes had been changed to a monk's robe, the Lama said, 'Your name is now Mila Vajra, Banner of Victory.' And he bound me by the layman's vow and gave me the bodhisattva precepts. Through meditation, he consecrated the wine of inner offering in the skull cup of liberation. We all saw the wine bubbling with the light of the five colors. Marpa made an offering to his Lama and to his own personal deity, and then he drank, and he handed me the cup of wine, and I drained it. And then the Lama said, 'This is a good omen. A mere taste of my wine of inner offering is in itself superior to receiving the complete initiation of any other lineage.' And then he went on to initiate him into the mandala of a particular tantric deity and then recite the text to him that gave the account of that, of the practice of that mandala. And then he went on to say how he had received dreams and visions of Milarepa that foretold his passing on of this important lineage. One of the most poignant moments in the life of Milarepa, and one of the ones that I'm most fond of talking about with my students, came after he studied with Marpa and left to carry on his meditation by himself. He went off not to a cave to meditate, not into solitude, but he went back to his home to visit with his mother. The relationship between Buddhist monks and their mothers often is quite important in these traditions. Unfortunately, his mother had died and the house had fallen into ruin, but Milarepa used it in a, and used it instead simply as a meditation on impermanence. Let me read you an account of this episode. It's quite touching, I must say, really quite poignant. I entered the main room. The ruins of the hearth mingling with dirt formed a heap where the weeds grew and flourished. There were many bleached and crumbled bones. I realized that these were the bones of my mother. At the memory of her, I choked with emotion. Unifying my consciousness with that of my mother and with the enlightened mind of all of the lamas in the Kagyu lineage, I seated myself down on my mother's bones and meditated with a pure awareness without being distracted even for a moment in body, speech, or mind. Very powerful image of a tantric practice, you might say. I don't remember seeing anything like this in earlier Buddhism, simply sitting down on the bones of his mother, uniting his consciousness with hers, and using it as an occasion, not just really to come to terms with her and to touch her presence and to feel the significance of her life in his, but also to perceive directly in a physical way the reality of impermanence. Milarepa went on from this experience, of course, to become a great ascetic and a great meditator and the founder of an important lineage. But you can see from some of these stories, I think, why the model of Milarepa's life has been so touching for Tibetans and has really typified for them the life of a Tibetan sage. Now, there are two other schools that are worth mentioning. We need to say something about to complete our discussion of the four schools of Tibetan Buddhism. One of these is the Sakya school that emerged in the 11th century under the leadership of a lama named Drokmi. Drokmi was the teacher of Khunchok Gyaltsen, who in 1073 founded a monastery at Sakya in a place that gave the school its name. This school played an important role in negotiations between the Tibetans and the Mongols, who burst out of Mongolia in the 13th century and dominated, devastated, you might say, most of Asia. Eventually, interestingly enough, the Mongols converted to Tibetan Buddhism and became important protectors of Tibetan Buddhism, not just in Tibet, but also in other parts of Asia. Now, the 13th century, when the Mongols first appeared, was a crucial century in Tibet for a couple of reasons. First of all, it gave rise to this incipient political alliance between Tibetan monks and Mongol princes. This became an important theme in later Tibetan history. But it also was a time, the first century really, after the death of Indian Buddhism. Indian Buddhism ended around the year 1200. So in this century, the Tibetans really had to come of age as religious people and had to begin to fend for themselves. So you might say that the 13th century really marks, in some respects, the beginning of a truly independent Tibetan religious tradition. Today, the old alliance between the Tibetan lamas and the Mongols really is a difficult thing in Tibetan history because it's translated in the contemporary world into this troubling relationship with the Chinese regime. China has always viewed itself, at least in recent centuries, as being the heirs of the Mongols, and Chinese political leaders visualize Tibet as a part of the larger Chinese empire. Now, the fourth school that I want to mention, just briefly, before we bring this lecture to an end, is the Gelug, or Virtuous Way School, also known quite commonly in the literature as the Yellow Hats. This emerged in the 14th century under the leadership of the scholar Tsongkhapa, a great scholar and one whose works I have often used, especially to try to understand the relationship of Indian philosophical schools. Tsongkhapa followed the example of the Indian scholar Atisha, and he tried to establish a pure form of Indian monastic practice. This involved, in his case, an intense effort to try to codify not only the Tibetan approach to Buddhist philosophy, but to the stages of tantric practice. So Tsongkhapa is one of the great systematizers, really, of the Tibetan tradition. He wrote extensive, a great corpus of writings, not just on what's known as the Sutra tradition, the tradition of Mahayana philosophy, but also the tradition of Tantra. Tsongkhapa founded several major monasteries in central Tibet, two right near Lhasa and one a short distance away from Lhasa that was his home monastery, a monastery called Ganden, a name that means simply the pleasurable, like the name for the heaven where the Bodhisattva Maitreya resides. These have been some of the most influential religious institutions in the history of Tibet and have been actively restored in recent years. When I was in Lhasa just a couple of years ago, I had a chance to visit some of these monasteries and to understand, to appreciate the reverence that Tibetan people have had historically for Tsongkhapa. In fact, at Ganden, one of the most intriguing things to do when you visit the monastery is to do a circumambulation route around the monastery. It's not an easy place to get to. It's quite far up a long mountain road, but pilgrims come from all over Tibet to walk in the footsteps of Tsongkhapa around this monastery and try to discern his presence in fingerprints and footprints in the rock. So Tsongkhapa, the founder of this lineage, is revered not just by scholars and monks, but also by common people as a great saint. After the death of Tsongkhapa, the leadership of the Gelug school passed to the lineage of the Dalai Lamas. And the Dalai Lamas will be the topic of our next lecture.